Case number 18-1300 et al. Constellium Rural Products, Ravenswood, LLC, petitioner versus National Labor Relations Board. Mr. Johnson for the petitioner, Mr. Kent Ward for the respondent.
May it please the Court, I'm Harry Johnson here to argue today for Petitioner Constellium. Two things about this case leap out for the Court's attention. First, a severe conflict with Title VII. And second, a clear departure from the Board's prior precedent in these areas without any reasoned justification. We have an overarching argument that covers both aspects of this case, and that is simply this. Because the employee's activity in this case, which was scrawling an epithet on an overtime sign-up sheet posted on the employer's official bulletin board, as a threshold matter was not protected under the National Labor Relations Act. Then the court, in order to deny enforcement and reverse the board here, doesn't need to get to the Atlantic Steel balancing test.
That's one thing.
Yes, Your Honor.
You seem to have argued throughout, and again, and certainly quite clearly in your reply brief, that he was discharged for the act of defacement, not for the content of his message. Is that right?
Well, defacement is certainly one reason, but if you look at
On page 9 of your reply brief, it was Mr. Williams' italicized act of defacement that led to the disciplinary response.
That is certainly one of the main reasons that Mr. Williams was disciplined.
I mean, if he had defaced it but without the epithet, had defaced it with no right-thinking, loyal person who cares about his coworkers would sign up on this sheet. So he defaced it.
Right. It is likely
Would the company have taken the same position?
It is likely that it would have because, simply speaking, there are no comparators that anyone had ever gone up and defaced an official company document on the company's bulletin board where it struck out the header of the overtime sign-up sheet.
Your argument here seemed to be very strongly the United Artists Theater defacement. It doesn't matter what you're saying. It's the act of defacement. It was what motivated the discharge here, and they'd put up with the word when it was orally spoken by people. They just, with the act of defacement.
Well, I think the act of defacement was a primary motivator in this case. There is no question about that. I also think if you look at the record in this case, the employer here did try and make some good faith efforts under a zero tolerance policy to tamp down on graffiti in the workplace besides just this particular defacement. It is clear, though, that under United Artists, and I agree with you, that the board there ruled that under no circumstances would defacement be protected. It goes on the lines of the vandalism cases, where vandalism isn't protected, which is one of the three reasons why the conduct in this case isn't protected. One, vandalism. Two, it took over the employer's bulletin board, which belongs to the employer for its messaging. And three, the venomous, sexually demeaning epithet that was used. At the end of the day, even if you do get to the Atlantic Steel balancing test, because of the nature of the conduct, it's so egregious, it is a venomous, sexually demeaning epithet, it is vandalism, and it does take over the employer's
bulletin board. Well, it would be vandalism even if it wasn't a sexually demeaning epithet. That's what I'm trying to understand. Your opening brief, the first two headings are all about defacement. Your reply brief says, look, it was the act of defacement, that's the reason we discharged him, none of which has anything to do with the epithet he used.
There is no question that defacement standing alone would be an independent reason for his discharge, and there's no question that it's one of the primary reasons. If you look at the notice that was given to the employee, though, about his conduct and why the employer had a problem with it, it does mention that it was harassing. And the testimony by the Harmison,
who does the employer think was being harassed?
everyone in the plant. I mean, this employer had $1 million jury verdict rendered against it for offensive gender workplace environment. And that's the reason why it had the zero tolerance policy. There were also several.
You had a zero tolerance policy, but you said that, and the board found that oral use of this phrase was commonplace, including by a supervisor. Not denied, as I read it. And so that doesn't sound like a zero tolerance. So that's what I'm trying to understand exactly. Is your argument a zero tolerance for defacing property, a zero tolerance for writing epithets as part of defacement, or?
I understand, Your Honor. Basically, the employer had never allowed defacement of this kind before, number one.
Of this kind, just defacement?
Just defacement, yes. Uh-huh. Number two, because of the zero tolerance policy, the employer did regard this as an escalation in the types of epithets that were used. Number three, there is testimony in the record, and the board didn't make any fact-finding to discredit any of this testimony, that the decision makers in this case, vis-a-vis Williams, never consciously allowed other supervisors, for example, to go on and use this term, never consciously allowed employees to get away with this term. The fact is that they testified.
Sorry, what does consciously allowed mean?
Well, they see and know about a supervisor using this term, for example, and then they go ahead and allow it. I think if you go through the record, yes, there is evidence that there's some employees who testify the term was used, the employees use the term. There's some employees that say supervisors use the term. But at the end of the day, there was a good faith attempt here to tamp down on the workplace culture, and we think that goes right to the heart of the problem that the NLRA, the board spin on the NLRA has in this case, because the repeated use of an epithet, of course, under Title VII creates a hostile work environment. Under the board's logic in this case, the repeated use of an epithet creates an excuse for more epithets, and even an escalation to get from a verbal epithet to a written epithet posted up on a board for 24 hours or even 48 hours. We think at the end of the day.
Does the record say anything about the use of the word, the oral use of this or other related words, in the presence of female employees?
No, there is nothing in the record affirmatively on that. In fact, most of the discussions were apparently on the radio. This particular maintenance department appears to have all male employees. Some of the male employees were offended, Your Honor, which is what brought this to the employer's attention. In fact, one of the employees broke down during the interview process and started crying.
Employees that were signing up to do the overtime.
Yes, it was one of those people.
Any evidence that women would have been in the area that would have seen where this the sign-up sheet was?
The record is it was in heavily trafficked, openly accessible area of the plant, next to a time clock, next to an official bulletin board.
The employer, did you put on evidence that women were in this area?
There is evidence in the record. You can see in Joint Appendix at 20. You can see it from the fact that two women actually sued the employer who were employees
about different postings.
Posting.
Saying it's heavily trafficked doesn't answer the question, heavily trafficked by whom? And so was this in an area? Did you put evidence in the record? That's what I'm really asking. Did you put evidence in the record that women were in this area?
There is evidence in the record that women could come through this area. To be responsive to your question, Your Honor, there isn't anything in the record that says a certain woman definitely passed through this area and we knew about it. But certainly it's the employer's reasonable belief. If you look at the Adtrans case, basically the D.C. Circuit tells employers you've got to have a zero tolerance policy and you've got to try and tamp down on this kind of thing. And that's simply what the employer was doing.
Does the record indicate whether there were any female employees who either do work overtime sometimes or are in positions where overtime was possible?
On this particular overtime board, the record is silent on that. But I also would
point out... I thought you just said that this particular unit for which this overtime applied was all male.
It appears from the record that it is all male. But I would point out that the Forrest case from the First Circuit basically says that it's a gender-specific epithet. The Reeves case says that even where a term like whores were used to refer to men, that usage may not make the epithets any less offensive to women on account of gender. If this posting had been up for 48 hours, if the employer hadn't detected it originally, anyone could have walked through there. There's no question that this is a mixed workforce of males and females. It looks like I don't have that
Mr.
much.
Mr. Johnson, I just want to ask you a quick question about whether you properly raised this issue before the board. In your answering brief, you discuss the issue, that is, the relationship between this and anti-harassment laws. But they're in sections dealing with defacement, whether defacement constitutes protected activity, and on the Atlantic Steel factors, which is a different argument than you're making here. And I didn't see anywhere in the brief where you discussed this accommodation issue or cited all the cases.
So all right, well,
why is this issue properly raised?
The standard is just to put the board on adequate notice.
Yeah, I know
that this
the
kind of,
okay, do you think right. The board would have had adequate notice?
I do think so, because Constellium expressly argued in its original brief that this was foul language, mm-hmm. especially in the context of gender discrimination, and the general counsel's mm-hmm. contrary position would, quote, eliminate the company's ability to police the workplace, unquote, and would cause, quote, serious tension, unquote, with, quote, the law and workplace standards, and that's in Joint Appendix 114 through 115. And the employee's violation in this case was described in the notice precisely mm-hmm. as harassment in Joint Appendix 234. We don't think Ensign was required to do anything more, especially given the fact that the ALJ's decision here, if you remember, didn't get to Title VII at all. And in fact, the general counsel didn't raise
it. Did you argue Title VII to the ALJ?
In the brief. We argued that under the totality of circumstances test, for example, this was offensive language. And that's.
Did you argue that as part of the Atlantic Steel analysis or the totality of circumstances analysis, the implications for EEO laws had to be factored in? Did you argue that to the ALJ?
Well, that was argued before the board when I did those quotes I just made. In terms of the ALJ,
I don't think you mentioned federal. I didn't see the words. I didn't see the acronym EEO or Title VII or
federal
anti-discrimination law anywhere in there.
There was a case made to the ALJ that this was foul and offensive language. There was put in front of the ALJ the notice to the employees saying that they violated the harassment policy. And the last thing I could say to just in terms of how the workplace regarded this, Kevin Gall, who's the union grievance committee chairman who sees all the disciplines, testifies in this case that it was never appropriate to put up this kind of posting in the workplace. So if basically this had been some acceptable form of conduct, you would have expected him to testify, oh, this happened all the time.
Well, that's the merits. The question is whether you've raised the issue. That's the only reason I asked.
Right. And we did, like this court tells us in HTH, we did put forth a motion for reconsideration that quite expressly reached the issue, and the board simply said, well, we already considered this.
And okay,
one of
thank
the members.
You, Mr. Thank you. We'll hear from the board.
May it please the court, Jared Cantor on behalf of the National Labor Relations Board. The board would ask the court to enforce its order because Williams did not lose the protection of the act, and that finding is reasonable and supported by substantial evidence. Picking up where my brother at the bar left off, the board would, and as we do, strongly pushes back on its argument that its answering brief apprised the board of the argument it's making in front of this court that the board's should have, in this case, accommodated EEO, Title VII, state anti-discriminations, that's a very specific, when you're asking the board to essentially accommodate other statutes, that's a very specific claim that they make very well in their belated motion for reconsideration. So they knew that argument. but they did not flesh it out at the time that they should have. And this similarly goes to the board's finding that this is a case about discipline arising from the protected content of what Mr. Williams did, that this is not a defacement case. And that goes once again to the notice that Mr. Williams received, that if what concerned them was defacement, it would say, we are suspending you with an intention to discharge you because you defaced. Instead, it talks about your willful and his harassing conduct, insulting and harassing conduct, using this, what I would submit, had essentially become a term of art within this shop.
Well, could you, so look at J125, 126. That's where they talk about, look, this the word used here was exactly the same, or the functional equivalent of the words, and this is they're telling the board, for which we were just held liable under state anti-discrimination laws for creating a hostile and abusive work environment, that's EEO law, by a court in West Virginia. And if you rule against us here, we're not going to be able to police foul language like that. How did that not put them on notice?
Well, Your Honor, I think that puts the board on notice in the sense of the analysis that it conducted as to the employer's legitimate concerns here balanced against the employee's rights. But to say then that the board needs to reconfigure its entire jurisprudence to accommodate these statutes or rule them.
No, it just means they needed to answer it.
Well, I think the board answers it in its analysis here when it looks at what this term meant in the shop.
And then how can you say now it's not preserved?
What's not preserved is there. Well, first of all, they brief none of the Atlantic Steel analysis or the totality of the circumstances. So the board's actual analysis under all the factors stands unchallenged in front of the court. What's tenied is the argument they're making that this decision needs to be denied enforcement and sent back because they asked the board at the appropriate time and place to reconfigure its jurisprudence to accommodate. Essentially, they're asking this court what the board is considering in its notice and invitation for briefs, reconceptualizing its entire jurisprudence in this area. Their concerns about harassment are addressed.
I don't think any respondent comes before the board and asks for some enormous rethinking of its jurisprudence. It raises a specific issue, which may then trigger the board's doing that. Turns out the board's doing it anyway, right?
Well, yes, Your Honor, but what their argument here was, and certainly at this point, as we argue, has been waived. They disputed the Atlantic Steel analysis. They disputed the totality of the circumstances analysis.
What Judge Millett read to you is from their alternative analysis under Atlantic Steel.
Or totality of circumstances, either one, right? They do it under both. They do it also on 122. Right. So.
Correct, Your Honor. And respectfully submitted, that is would be insufficient to apprise the board that they're making this argument. When you read their motion for reconsideration and their brief to this court, there that argument is, you read it and you understand the argument that they are making. The argument that they are making in their answering brief on those two is essentially reiterating the fact part of their brief where they say, we were really concerned about this, that's why we did what we did. The board didn't say you didn't have a concern over.
Didn't the dissenting member of the board acknowledge this issue?
The dissenting member, Emanuel, he departs from the board when he says this is a case about defacement, which is what the ALJ had said. The board disagrees.
But he also notes this issue as well, does he not?
Does he?
He also notes the concern about gender or racial.
Yes, he telegraphs that.
And then when the petition for reconsideration comes in, he says, well, I obviously disagree. I would deny reconsideration because it doesn't argue anything when it makes the EEO point that it hadn't already argued.
Well, Your Honor, respectfully.
Was he wrong?
That's not what he's. They quote part of a member Emanuel's footnote from denying the motion for reconsideration. His language there basically just merely parrots what's in the CFR subsection that governs motion for reconsiderations.
The gist of his. He agrees that respondent has not raised any issue not previously considered or shown extraordinary circumstances. So he agrees that respondent's brief, motion for reconsideration, has not raised any issue not previously considered. And as you said, they very well briefed in their motion for reconsideration, the CEO issue. So well, how could he say that they hadn't raised any issue that wasn't previously considered if it hadn't previously been presented to them?
Well, Your Honor, the second part, his full footnote talks about agrees that the respondent has not raised any issue not previously considered or shown extraordinary circumstances warranting reconsideration. Mm-hmm. And their motion for reconsideration had three bases. Remember Emanuel's footnote
but
there.
But when he raised it in his initial dissent, was he making it up for them?
No, I think he was telegraphing his joining the majority in the General Motors notice and invitation over the dissent of McFerrin. I view that more as a dialogue between the dissent and the majority, which is very common in board decisions.
Board members allowed to raise arguments that parties haven't? I have no idea. Just procedurally, do they get to raise arguments that parties haven't?
Yes, they do. And under well-established board 10E jurisprudence, even if the board sua sponte raises an issue, that does not preserve it for 10E because the party a party has to raise the objection. There was a lot of discussion earlier about the record here and what the record, to the extent Your Honors are interested in it, otherwise I'll yield back the balance of my time because I know it's been a long day for the panel. When you look at these overtime sheets...
We can go a lot longer if we need to.
Okay.
Don't worry about us.
The record shows that indeed that this sub-unit, sub-shop where Mr. Williams worked, that the ALJ looks at all the names that were on the two sign-up sheets, and he says, well, there's three that have, it could be, you know, one gender or the other, Terry, Bobby, and I think there was one more. Mr. Williams testified when asked about the names on these overtime sheets, one of which is his, that everyone on there was all men. And Judge Millett, you were asking my brother at the bar about, or he was talking about how long this was up and women passing back and forth. What the record indicates is that Mr. Williams wrote this at the end of his shift, and then it was brought to management's attention, and it was taken down essentially almost immediately. Because as the board talks about in its analysis, this was scheduled
well,
to be taken...
24 hours isn't almost immediately.
Huh?
24 hours isn't almost immediately.
It was not up there for 24 hours, Your Honor.
I thought it was due to go down the next day.
It was due to, but it was taken down once this was brought to management's attention.
Do you know how long that was?
There's no discussion in the record about when... It was just brought to management's attention. I believe Mr. Williams, in the record, one of the exhibits has his clock out time, his punch out time. I believe it was three or four, mostly a normal working period day, but it was brought to management's attention. And as the board focuses on in its analysis, it was taken down early, and it was already scheduled to go the next day. So it was not up there for a very long time. There is nothing...
So if it had been up for 48 hours, would it be a different issue?
I don't think that would...
I was just curious as to why they thought that. Man, I mean, again, if something's up there for such a fleeting time that nobody but the supervisor who tears it down sees it, that's one thing. But that's not what was argued here. So I'm not sure why you get to use racial or gender epithets as long as it's not for very long.
Well, Your Honor, I think that goes to the board looking at the Atlantic Steel and looking at what their interest would be. Certainly, as we point out in a footnote in our brief, there's nothing wrong with them then taking this down. I mean, the governing question in this case is...
But I think, am I reading the decision of the board right, that every single day this could get written on the paper again?
No, Your Honor, I don't...
This protected activity is part of this... Continue. I assume it's, let's assume it's still ongoing. I don't know what's happened in the interim, but assume it were still an ongoing dispute, it wouldn't be a protected activity to keep writing it?
Well, Your Honor, this dispute eventually was resolved and the parties ended up changing the agreement. But
the
yes, Your Honor.
Day, it got
no, well,
again.
I think that would go in, that would affect the board's analysis where it talks about that this was spontaneous, it was unplanned misconduct. And certainly,
I don't
it
know
start
how it can be spontaneous and unplanned when it was the natural outgrowth of an ongoing course of protected activity. That seems a little odd.
Well, no, Your Honor, I don't respectfully don't think so because it certainly did. This did not come out of the blue. This was not him raising a personal gripe out of the blue. That this is part of the unit's concerted action against the employer's
that's
implementation.
That's how everyone referred to this sheet.
Huh?
Right. It was common parlance that this sign-up was referred to by that phrase?
Yes, Your Honor. As I said, this had become essentially a term of art. I would think that if he had went up there and written anything else to describe it.
A term of art?
In the sense of people knew what this meant when people were referring to it. Ideally, yes, of course, we would have wanted them to have picked the oppressive board, some other term. But in the context, this is what employees were calling it. The
right,
record
and if the dispute was going on, let's say it went on for another year, what would stop an employee from writing it every time the sheet goes up, an employee writes it?
Well, a couple things, Your Honor. Again, it would start weighing against that employee for the repeated part of the misconduct. That's the balancing in Atlantic Steel. And certainly as
But is it not a repeated exercise of protective conduct?
Well, but you can eventually lose the protection of the Act. And as some of the board cases
so if you
discuss
say we repeat the epithet often enough, you lose the protection?
Well, you may indeed, Your Honor. It really would depend. And certainly, as some of the cases discuss, where it then becomes an issue of insubordination or repeated bad conduct, at some of the cases where we have multiple instances of graffiti or vandalism before and after an employee is warned, that changes the calculus. All of these cases are, as in any Atlantic Steel or loss of protection case, they're extremely fact-intensive. Whether you're looking at the totality of the circumstances or going through each one of the factors, it really is a fact-intensive type inquiry.
Can I just ask you one other question? The board said the United Artists Theater argument was raised. That's on the different year. That's sort of categorical rule against defacement. And the answer is the board has never held that employee graffiti is always unprotected. And United Artists Theater, on which the judge relied, did not establish such a per se rule. I'm on JA 133.
Yes, sir.
But that is exactly what United Artists said, right? I find that the writing of graffiti on elevator walls and restroom walls and employee is not protected activity, and that's 127 of United Artists, and on 128, my conclusion turns on the proposition that the writing of graffiti or defacing an employer's property as a means of the propagation of a slogan is under no circumstances a protected activity at the threshold, Section 7.
Yes, Your Honor.
So it seems like the board's distinction was just not accurate.
Respectfully, Your Honor, certainly the language that the judge used in this case is the judge's language.
The board adopted this decision, so this is the board's language.
Yes, it is
okay,
the
so
board's
the language of the board there. I'm just asking you whether they were wrong when they said they might have other explanations, like we've overtaken, that was a one-off, other precedents overtaken it, but the explanation they gave was we've never held that employee graffiti is always unprotected.
Yes, Your Honor, and I think it's...
That was just wrong.
No, the board is correct in saying it has never held that. I think when you look at the language there, the judge, as adopted by the board in United Artists, was really focusing on the specific facts of that case. Indeed, the first sentence that you read where the judge said, at the threshold, I find that the writing of graffiti on elevator walls and restroom walls of an employer is not, I mean, he was
right, but
very much...
My conclusion turns on, so this sounds like a holding, the proposition that the writing of graffiti or defacing of employers' property as a means of propagation of slogans is under no circumstances a protected activity, and therefore the threshold is conduct dissociated from Section 7.
Yep.
That doesn't have any of those qualifications, and that seems to be his sum-up conclusion holding that the board adopted.
Well, two parts, Your Honor. One, I mean, he capitalizes the employer. So once again, he's very much looking at what this employee did in that case, and indeed, in that case, he found that the graffiti in there was unprotected, the content of it, because it was obscene and offensive. And he also, as the rest of that sentence makes clear, he talks about it's clearly unlike misconduct occurring during the course of protected activity.
So for this particular employer, you could never have protected defacement or graffiti? That's your answer?
Well, Your Honor, I think it would turn on the graffiti that was being written, and certainly in this... As the board emphasizes in a footnote in this decision when talking about this, it says even to the extent that the judge here used this very strong language, he also, there are findings in here consistent with the loss of protection analysis, and where the judge also, I'm thinking of the board's footnote, and it's escaping me where the board made one other point.
That they were obscene and offensive.
Yes, that he was looking at what was done there. And I think... Interpreting United Artists in this way, then, makes sense when you look at all of these board cases. The company points to some, we point to some. it would be like any old verbal Atlantic Steel case where you can find a dozen cases where someone said something in a loud voice or aggressively or made aggressive movements. And just because in some cases that loud, aggressive language was found to have cost you the protection of the Act, and just because in other cases you retain the protection of the Act, it's not that the board is departing from its jurisprudence and is all over the place. It's because these are really very fact-intensive.
Mr. Cantor, wouldn't you agree that insofar as the cases arise from picket line conduct, the board could reasonably be more tolerant than cases arising of epithets and so on, or insults arising in a placid environment?
Yes, Your Honor. I have never litigated a picket line misconduct case, but certainly it's true when the board under Atlantic Steel looks at the location, it does look whether this was in a supervisor's office, whether it was out in the open. One of the factors of Atlantic Steel looks at, I mean, this is almost your quintessential old school industrial setting. This is a rolled aluminum manufacturing on the floor of the shop. And that is
the fact that the employer's property was used for the epithet factor in, or should that factor in?
Well, I think it certainly does, Your Honor. At page 4 of the DNO, which is page 135 of the 35 of the appendix, the board, as part of its analysis, and it's also in discussion with the dissent on this, says, you know, we are considering the employer's interest here. It has a property interest, it had an interest in its overtime system, and it had an interest in not having this defaced. But the question is, as under all Atlantic Steel...
But they don't have an interest in not having their property used for racial or gender epithets?
Well, I mean, I think that would be, that's still captured within the, that would be the employer's interest, of course, in maintaining a harassment-free workplace, just like it would be in
well, it's a distinct interest, and I don't want my property used for that, those types of distinctly offensive and harmful words.
Yes, Your
Honor. On top of my general desire to control how my property is used.
Yes. And certainly the board is, as they point, as the company points out, is considering Your Honor's concerns as expressed in your concurrence.
But a woman who walks by and sees that, they're not going to know who wrote it up there. They're going to see this official posting of the employer captioned this race.
Well, Your Honor, that maybe would be a slightly different case if those were the facts.
No, that's this case. Huh? Right? It was written at the top, so it was like the caption of the sign-up sheet. And they know that this is something the employer puts out, the sign-up sheet.
I mean, certainly, Your Honor,
there's a distinct interest there.
Well, Your Honor, again, that's why they were allowed to remove it. And that's why, these Atlantic Steel cases are about misconduct.
Why were they allowed? They were allowed to remove it because it was their sign-up sheet?
Correct. And certainly, I know they focus a lot on the bulletin board aspect of this. This could have just as easily been taped to a wall or a door.
What else was on the bulletin board?
So the bulletin board that they have here is the bulletin board itself. The pin board is actually under glass. So this then is taped on the outside of the glass because employees are expected to write on it.
What else was on the bulletin board under the glass?
There are photos. I believe there were notices to employees. There might have been an OSHA notice.
Maybe an EEO notice?
I believe there's testimony that they had one of their workplace policies up there. I don't know if they had an EEO notice up there.
It sounds like employees were expected to look at this bulletin board even if they weren't there to sign up for overtime.
I don't think we could dispute that this is where the employer posted notices to this group of...
They were expected to look and learn about messages the employer wanted to communicate to them.
Yes, I mean, again, this is a misconduct case. The board is not saying here that there is a right to go and do this, that it's a question about whether this was so egregious as to be indefensible and as to justify terminating Mr. Williams. And that brings in all the protections of well-established labor law and the board's very reasoned analysis under Atlantic Steel or totality, none of which, again, the company, I mean, it's hung its hat on the first part of the argument and I think very strategically decided not to fight the board on any of the loss of protection analysis. I see I am way over my time. If there are...
Okay. Thank you. Did Mr. Johnson have any time left?
There was no time remaining.
You could take 1 minute.
Excuse me. So I'll just cover a bunch of points.
Parkwood
is the waiver standard. That's if the respondent neglects to discuss everything. I think it's a complete failure of the board's fact-finding to find that this is a provoked act or a spontaneous act. This notice, this policy dispute had been in effect for 6 months by the time this person engaged in a premeditated act.
You're just making a fact dispute now. Right, the board found it was spontaneous, and that's a fact-finding. So you're making a fact-finding.
Right, I'm making a universal camera point that if you look at the evidence in this case, there are no facts that this was some sort of provoked or spontaneous act, given the back policy been up. There's no legitimate communicative value given the policies of NLRA and what the whole message was the two-word whore board. Under Emerson Electric, the board held employees can't even put graffiti on pieces of scrap metal. That are going to be used. This is, last point, this is in essence a coerced speech case because I think the zero tolerance policy was up on the board. If you look at joint appendix 40 through 41, 48, and 240 through 244, and that policy said, we as the employer do not approve of harassment and we want harassing and insulting conduct to stop. This employee came up and replaced that message in effect with, we think.
Could you ever use the phrase coerced speech in an argument to the board or ALJ?
No. I think that it was argued in the context of the employer's the right to maintain discipline and production. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Case is submitted.